done with this conversation, Kayla. I'm sorry I brought you into this. You're free to leave. I won't hold it against you, I promise, but seriously, enough. I'm not going anywhere. Good. Then knock it off. I'm glad that you feel you have a frame of reference when grade A sci-fi crazy is thrust into the middle of your life, but I don't, okay? And I've had one of the craziest lives of anyone I know. I'm doing the best I can with this. But you're gonna have to forgive me for thinking we're in uncharted waters here and that a lot of the old rules don't apply anymore. This drug, wherever it came from, it was given to me by a man with crazy black op skills who assumed a cover identity for 3 months so he could earn my trust. If you think I'm gonna try to fight off a man like that with the FBI, who didn't capture the Bannings for over a decade, by the way, you're the one who's not thinking clearly. I want to know how this pill works. And I can't exactly walk into a CVS and ask the pharmacist, okay? But if me trying to get some knowledge here freaks you out, fine. I'll clear out of here and figure out my next move and you can forget we ever met up today. Kayla swallows, but Charlie can tell what she'd really like to do is roll her eyes and groan. But she doesn't do either. Instead, she turns to Marty and says, "Why aren't you trying to help me here?"
"I don't know you that well, to be frank," he says. "It's Charlie I'm here to help. And it seems to me if this Dylan guy was such a threat to her, he wouldn't have given her a bunch of pills that made it easy for her to rip his face off."
"People can do a lot of harm from a distance," Kayla whispers. "Especially powerful people." "We need to find out how powerful this particular guy is."
"Sure. But if he were all that powerful, what the hell does he need Charlie for?"
Marty asks.
"I mean, no offense, darling, I'm crazy about you, but you're not exactly the leader of the free world."
It's a damn good point, she thinks for the first time. Things have moved so fast these past few hours, she hasn't stopped to ask the most important question. "Why me?"
"Look," Marty says, "Charlie's right. There's no frame of reference for this stuff. I'd rather see her do something than worry herself into crazy by speculating about who this asshole is when she could be figuring out what he gave her. She wants to try to make the most of a colossally shitty situation I'm in. I've got a gun in my trunk, and I know my way around some really sketchy places."
Kayla's chest rises and falls.
"Fine,"
she finally says.
"I've got a gun, too."
16. The bar looks like the dirt beside the irrigation canal burped up an old trailer it couldn't swallow. There's no sign, just a smattering of decrepit cars and pickup trucks that suggests most of the clientele inside is more meth than man. According to Marty, it's the kind of dive where the regulars find their favorite stool by noon, are singing along to every song on the jukebox by 3, and then by dinner time are lecturing anyone who'll listen about how the world's done them wrong their whole miserable lives. By 11, they're ready for a fight. Or something worse, if they've managed to score a pick-me-up from one of the resident dealers, who may or may not also be the bartender. It's 10 to 11 now. She's showered and brushed her hair out, and she's wearing a fresh outfit Kayla picked up for her at the nearest Walmart. Jeans and a baggy powder blue t-shirt. She looks like a lot of women do when they go grocery shopping. But in this hellhole she's bound to draw attention, just because her clothes don't stink of spilled beer. Attention is exactly what she gets when she pushes the door open. A blast of stale beer, along with something more acrid and unidentifiable, hits her with enough force to make her eyes water. There's a pool table off to her left. At first, she thinks the men gathered around it are in the midst of some verbal altercation that's about to turn physical. 2 of them are nose to nose,
One shouting into the face of the other in a high-pitched, barking voice. And he's using lots of hand gestures while he does it. It takes her a second to realize the man's aggression is reserved for the asshole supervisor he's describing in his shrill tale of workplace woe. His volume and his movements are probably the result of whatever's got him hopped up, and the guy he's talking to doesn't put distance between them because he's too drunk to be bothered. The most unnerving thing about this little scene is that no one, not his friends and not the bartender, is asking him to quiet the hell down. Heads turn as she passes. She feels the men's stares like pinpricks on her skin. Each look almost slides past her, then catches on the side of her bare arms and braless chest and youthful features, and locks in like motion-activated security cameras finding an intruder. She counts two other women in the place. One's passed out at one end of the bar, the other's sandwiched in a corner booth in between two hulking guys who look like bikers. Her glazed eyes focus on nothing in particular while the men talk across her. Occasionally they slam the table with the sides of their fists to make a point. The impacts are strong enough to jostle their beer bottles, but the woman, who wears an outfit slightly more revealing than Charlotte's, doesn't even flinch. She's somewhere far away from this place. Maybe someplace with blue sky and birds, and men who acknowledge her presence. Charlotte takes a seat at the bar. The pill's been in her system for an hour. That's about the same amount of time it took her to get from Dylan's office to her house. To distract herself from the look she's getting, she makes a mental checklist of the symptoms she's on the lookout for. The shaking hands, the throbbing in her bones, the phenomenon she's nicknamed bone music. The former, she thinks, is a sign the drug's about to kick in. The second, that it's in full bloom throughout her body. But these are just guesses. There's still a lot she's not sure of. Not yet. That's what tonight's about. The nearest bartender glares at her, but he doesn't come over. His glare seems both a warning and a dismissal. When she hears the bar's door open, she fights the urge to look over her shoulder. But she's sure it's Marty. He's changed into a baseball cap and some paint-splattered clothes from his truck that conceal the gun he's now carrying on his hip. The plan is, he'll keep her within sight at all times while he tries to hang back. Marty only told her one story about this place. It was general, but it was enough. One of his AA sponsees had to make a serious amends for something he'd done here. An amends that involved him turning himself into the police and pleading guilty to a charge that got him 10 years in Folsom. And the reason he'd had to turn himself in is because no one in this place reported what he and two of his buddies did to a woman in the corner while everyone else drank beer and played pool. Not even the woman, even though she'd lost most of her teeth during it. Outside, Kayla has parked her car a short walk from the bar's entrance, next to the tall, spiked steel fence designed to keep drunks from driving into the water supply for the nearby farms. If all goes as planned, she'll have a front-row seat to Dylan Thorpe's magic show. And so will Marty. And so will whoever makes the mistake of following Charlotte out of this place. "Can I get a drink?" she asks. It's not that she's rude. It's that she doesn't keep her eyes averted or soften her tone. She doesn't ask the question the way these men believe a visitor, especially a female one, should. She doesn't address them in a way that says, "You're in charge, big boy, and I remain here at the pleasure of your bad attitude." The wording alone calls attention to how brazenly the bartender's been ignoring her and sends a ripple of tension through the two men seated at the bar next to her. They rouse like coiling snakes. One of them runs fingers over his sweating beer bottle. The other taps out a frenetic rhythm on his. Both study her, their jaws working, as if the five words she just spoke have awakened a predatory energy inside them. The bartender comes over, stands in front of her. This isn't the type of place where a napkin precedes a drink order. Diet Coke, she says, staring him in the eye.
You want a lemon in that?
The bartender asks. Sure.
There's a Save Mart about 10 minutes from here. I hear they got 'em on sale.
The bartender departs. The guy closest to her at the bar cackles, punching his friend lightly in the elbow. Charlotte locks eyes with him. For a second she worries that her gaze is too steady, too intimidating, that her knowledge of what she might be able to do to him if he tries to harm her has given her a confidence that might frighten the guy into submission. She's wrong. His mouth curls into a sneer. It's a similar reaction to the one Thor the biker gave her when she refused to pull over on his command. Only now she's seeing it up close. His baseball cap is on backward, giving her a full view of his bloodshot, rheumy eyes, his bulbous drinker's nose. He's stocky and about her age, but years of hard living make him look 10 years older, and she's not sure how much of his bulk is muscle or just beer fat. His buddy is watching her, too. Only his baseball cap is turned forward, hiding his face in shadow. He's slouched forward on the bar, staring at her. Either he's the more focused of the two or the more drunk. She tries to imagine both men crying out in pain, the way Jason did the night before when she broke his shoulder. It feels like a version of that old mental trick people recommend when you have to speak in front of a large group. Just imagine everyone in their underwear. But the trick backfires. It doesn't make the men glowering at her now seem more human or less threatening. It doesn't, in her mind's eye at least, dim the flames of their evident hostility toward her.
"You cop?" Backward Cap asks.
"You a criminal?" she asks.
"Cops wear bras,"
Forward Cap says, his voice just above a growl.
"Lady ones do, at least,"
his friend adds. "I wouldn't know," Charlotte says. She turns her attention to the television above the bar. Both men fall silent, but she can feel their stares. She's here to attract a criminal, not create one. But for this to work, the line between enticement and entrapment will be thin. And right now she doesn't see a lot of other options. Marty had insisted on his ridiculous test on the way over, and it had been a total flop. Right after she'd taken the pill, he asked her to start slowly walking toward the nose of the car, into the glare of the headlights so she couldn't see what he was doing behind the wheel. Then he'd tried startling her with bleats of the horn to see if he could trigger the drug. When that didn't work, he'd put his foot on the gas and accelerated toward her, slamming on the brakes at the last possible second. It had scared the crap out of her, and almost caused Kayla to put a bullet in him. But it wasn't enough. It didn't recreate the raw, primal fear of being attacked by Jason in her own home. And neither, apparently, does sitting in this bar, surrounded by guys who look like they want to eat her alive. When the bartender delivers her Diet Coke, which he's poured without ice into a grimy-looking glass, she grips it gently, realizes she's in no danger of breaking it, and takes a sip from it like an ordinary person. The shitty presentation of her drink sends a message. Hit the road. Maybe the guy's pissed because she asked to be treated the same as his male patrons. Or maybe he thinks she's in real danger and doesn't want to deal with the resulting mess if she sticks around. She pulls out the money clip Marty lent her. The one Kayla gave her $100 in 20s for. She flashes the bills conspicuously. If her words, attitude, and outfit don't end up making her a target for a bastard, maybe the money will. The bartender watches her as she pushes a 20 across the bar. Then he picks it up, pockets it, and says,
"I'll start you a tab."
She's been only pretending to watch the television over the bar, but now the images on screen capture her full attention. They also take her back to two different places at once, which makes her head spin. Her house, when she'd come across the story of the first murder. The first face, she corrects herself. Online a few weeks ago. And Dylan's office the day before. A lifetime ago. Even though she'd played coy with him, the truth is, she did keep their agreement. She didn't even know there'd been a second killing. Now she does, thanks to an 11 o'clock newscast out of San Francisco. It's not a live shot. The helicopter footage of closed-down, traffic-snarled streets in Santa Monica has a subheading that says, Last Week, and the streets are bathed in early morning light. The chyron at the bottom of the screen says, New video released in Mask Maker Killings. Can you turn that up, please? She hears herself ask. The bartender appears in front of her.
This isn't a sports bar, girlie.
Does that look like sports to you, boyo? Forward and backward baseball cap don't whoop or whistle or make sarcastic sounds of encouragement over her retort. They glare at her, instead. On any other night, that'd be a bad sign. Tonight, it's a good one. The bartender, however, has followed her gaze. When he sees the footage of flaring police lights followed by a cheap black-and-white headshot of the mask maker's first victim in happier days, Charlotte's words shame him. He grabs the remote, raises the volume until the voices of the newscasters are barely audible. Identified as Kelly Sumter, who'd recently moved to Los Angeles to pursue acting ambitions and had changed her name to Harley Gray. But aside from the gruesome early morning discovery that shut down many Santa Monica streets late last week, the rest of 24-year-old Sumter's remains have not been found. Just her face. And now, in this surveillance video, which, we must warn you, many will find disturbing, we see the man police believe to be Sumter's killer, the Mask Maker. In it, he stages the horrifying scene that brought a city to a standstill just last week. The video's grainy and black and white, but she recognizes the statue from a visit she'd made to L.A. with Luann before she died. It stands at the spot where Wilshire Boulevard dead ends into Palisades Park, a long, palm tree-studded pedestrian thoroughfare that sits on a bluff high above Pacific Coast Highway and Santa Monica Bay. If the image were clearer, she might be able to make out waves in the dark ocean behind the statue. As it is, the statue's a shock of bright white amid a jungle of shadows. The video's star is a quick-moving figure who appears out of the right side of the frame like an apparition. Quick, stealthy, athletic, and based on what he does next, incredibly strong. He scales half the statue, slides his backpack to one side by dropping one strap from one shoulder, then he fastens something around the statue's head like a mask. The newscast cuts away before Charlotte, or anyone else watching at home, can linger on the details of the surgically removed human face. While there are few identifying features on the video to help law enforcement, detectives are still hoping something about these images will lead to the capture of this killer. The newscast cuts to a police detective, identified as Manuel Ramirez, in front of a phalanx of microphones. He's a wall of a man with salt-and-pepper hair. Charlotte can't tell if his eyes are sad or tired.
At this point, based on the video, we cannot assume the gender or ethnicity of the suspect. But what we can be sure of is that this person, even if not responsible for the murder itself, is most certainly an accessory. And we are doing everything we can to find them.
Questions erupt from the reporters, but the newscaster's narration takes over again. Just as Charlotte fears, the report cuts to the cell phone footage that horrified her and the rest of the country when it hit the internet. So far, no official statement on whether or not this killing has been linked by forensic evidence to a similar and equally gruesome discovery almost a month ago now at Griffith Observatory. That discovery involved the partial remains of 26-year-old West Hollywood fitness instructor Sarah Pratt. It's just as she remembered it. Jerky footage from someone walking toward the iconic observatory in bright morning sunlight. An entire group has just disembarked from a large tourist bus, which can be heard humming in the background beneath the excited chatter of its passengers. The man doing the shooting is still getting his bearings, capturing mostly the backs of heads in front of him as he tries to pan up to the observatory's domed roof. There's a series of high-pitched cries off to his right. As if they're unsure whether the cries are of warning or pleas for help, the crowd starts moving in that direction, and the cameraman goes with them. That's when he captures the James Dean Memorial, a bronze bust of the famous actor sitting on a white column of stone emblazoned with his name. The footage freezes at the first glimpse of the ill-fitting, grotesque mask of human skin that's been stretched across the bronze face underneath. But the audio continues uninterrupted, screams spreading throughout the crowd. The combination of a gruesomely defaced statue and the escalating panic of the crowd terrifies Charlotte as much as it had the first time. It's worse, maybe, than a gratuitous close-up of the ghostly face itself. But it's not enough to trigger the drug in her system. It's a different kind of horror, a revulsion she can feel in her gut. The killer's cruelty is the same kind that led Abigail Banning to whisper, "You are now nothing," into the ears of her victims before she cut their throats. The report cuts back to Detective Ramirez, who says,
"The staging, the manner of death, obviously those speak to a connection between these two crimes. But further forensic analysis is needed before we can make any other statements."
From the crowd, a reporter shouts,
"Are you not willing to call these crimes murders, or are you going to wait until the bodies are found?"
The detective stiffens.
"After consulting with forensic pathologists, we are reasonably sure it's not possible for these victims to have survived what was done to them."
The explosion of laughter startles her so badly, she almost falls off her stool. It's Backward Cap. He's doubled over the bar and is slapping it with one palm.
"Can you fucking imagine?"
he wheezes.
"Can you fucking imagine? What, like, you're there for some kid's fucking birthday and there's a fucking face on one of the fucking statues. I'd be like, do we pay extra for this bitch? 'Cause maybe I would have liked to have a selection to choose from, you know?"
Forward Cap says,
"You think they'd charge more depending on how hot she was?"
Backward Cap laughs harder.
"Or how big of a bitch she was? Hell, I'd pay, depending on the woman. Beats looking at a bunch of telescopes any day."
"What?"
his buddy asks.
"Are you on a game show? I'll take the face for 500, Pat."
"Alex," Charlotte says. Both men fall silent. At the sound of her voice, the bartender picks up the remote, kills the volume, and changes the channel. To sports. Even though this isn't a sports bar.
"What was that, Diet Coke?"
Forward Cap asks. He laughs less than his friend, and the long, studious looks he's been giving her since she sat down suggest that if he's not quicker to violence, he's better at planning it. Alex Trebek is the host of Jeopardy. Pat Sajak is the host of Wheel of Fortune. They just stare at her. Will this work? She hopes so. She's pretty sure she can provoke these guys. But throwing a drink in their faces to do it seems cheap, almost like entrapment. On the other hand, she's never met an arrogant ignoramus who didn't fly off the handle when corrected by the facts, especially from a woman. The game show you were referring to? The one where you pick a category and a dollar amount? That's Jeopardy.
"What's your problem, loose tits?"
Backward Cap asks. "Two women were murdered. Horribly. And you guys think it's funny. I'd say the problem is yours, and it's in your brains." Everything gets darker suddenly. The bartender is standing right over her, his formidable bulk blocking out the flickering television.
"Might be time for you to head back to San Francisco. Maybe get your kicks on Market Street. Here, that's a better place for girls with opinions."
Charlotte looks to the guys at her left. They're almost to the point of ignition, but they're not quite there yet. And if she lets their hero bartender put her in her place, then she might have lost them for good. "Soon as I finish my drink, sir," she says.
"The second you do,"
the bartender says. She nods. He moves away, but he's lingering.
"Uh-oh,"
Backward Cap says to his friend.
"Looks like we insulted Lady. Real one, too."
"No shit, huh?"
Forward Cap says.
"I don't know, maybe we should check those jeans. Seems like she's got a big old pair of balls to me."
"Huh. Well, you know what my dad always said about men and women?"
"What'd he say?"
"Come on, you know his old joke."
"Which one?"
"Why'd God give women vaginas?"
"So men would talk to them."
Charlotte lifts her glass to her mouth and drains the rest of her Diet Coke. Then she slams it down hard enough to suggest she's offended. She is, but in an abstract way. Mostly she's relieved they've set up her next line of attack so nicely. She stands, takes a step toward them. "You losers have about as much chance of being able to see what's in my pants as you do of finding a word in the dictionary." It's like she's thrown ice water in their faces. Maybe it's the insult, or maybe it's the confidence with which she hurled it. Either way, it's time for her to get moving. When she passes Marty's table, she locks eyes with him. He holds her gaze briefly, letting her know he's ready to follow. She's outside and headed along the irrigation canal when she hears the door open. She expects another verbal volley, maybe some shouted taunts or another disgusting joke about women. When she hears their footsteps punching gravel, she realizes this is escalating more quickly than she anticipated. The realization that they're only feet behind her now sends a familiar shiver through her entire body. Her hands begin to shake. It's a moment in which powerlessness and outrage collide and fight for prominence, producing several seconds of terrified paralysis, and it feels like it's enough to unleash the drug's power. They slam her into the fence from behind, a maelstrom of whiskey breath and wheezing grunts. Just as she'd planned, she reaches out and grabs two of the steel spokes. She forces herself to go limp, so they think they've got her. One's got his arms around her from behind and is grinding his groin against her ass. The other grips the back of her neck with so much pressure it should hurt like hell, but doesn't. His hot breath bathes her ear. They're laughing because they think they got her, and she's saying nothing because the bone music is back. This time it feels pleasurable, delicious even. Maybe because she knows what's really causing it.
"I got an idea how we're gonna get in those pants, you mouthy little bitch."
It's the one who has her by the neck. He's growling right into her ear. "Forward Cap." Backward Cap says,
"What are we gonna do with whatever we find there?"
"Well, if we like it, we help ourselves to a piece. If we don't, we'll cut it off."
Slowly, hoping they won't notice the motion right away, she begins to pull on both spikes. The resulting sound reminds her of train cars coming to a slow, tortured stop, the sound of steel being bent by a constant and steady force.
"Fuck,"
Forward Cap whispers. He releases her neck.
"Fuck!"
There's no malice in his voice now, just a kind of dumbstruck horror. They're both stumbling away from her. She's bent the spokes at almost 90-degree angles. Finally, the one in her right hand snaps free with a sound like a giant guitar string being flicked by a giant finger. A tug, and the one in her left hand comes free as well. When she turns, Forward Cap stumbles backward over his own feet. "Who likes hand jobs?" Charlotte asks. They run. A few seconds later, Kayla emerges out of the darkness, lowering the gun she's drawn. staring at the steel spikes in Charlotte's hand. Her jaws slack, her eyes are wide. She's shaking her head back and forth. From the other direction comes Marty. No drawn gun, probably because he had faith the drug would work. But he seems as awestruck as Kayla. And like her, he seems unwilling to get too close. "Talk to us," Kayla says. She sounds winded.
"Describe what you're feeling."
"What are you feeling?" Charlotte asks.
"Like I'm gonna wet myself, but don't answer a question with a question. It's annoying."
"Bone music," Charlotte answers.
"What?"
Marty asks. "It's like there's music playing inside my bones. Or a beat, at least."
"Like a waltz beat or a samba beat or a rave beat?"
"Is that a serious question?" Charlotte asks.
"Is it painful, is what I mean?"
"No," Charlotte says. "It's like I can't feel pain." "And I'd go with samba if I had to pick." She throws the spike in her left hand at the dirt with one downward thrust. It lands like a perfectly aimed spear. Kayla gasps. Then Charlotte takes the jagged end of the other spear and drives it slowly into her left palm. The pain is a dull, muffled thing. The skin should break, but it doesn't. Instead, it develops an instant dark bruise that comes on too fast, then seems to vanish the second she withdraws the steel. Like her body is trying to assert its usual response to being stabbed, but the drug suppresses it. Kayla and Marty flank her now.
"Keep talking, Charlotte," Kayla says.
"Okay. What do you want to know?"
"Just keep describing what you're feeling. Altered vision, mood changes."
"I'm not about to turn Incredible Hulk on either of you if that's what you're afraid of."
Hey, Charlie," Marty says. "Just a suggestion. Maybe hold the sarcasm until our entire sense of reality isn't being turned on its head."
"Sorry, but this is just the kind of moment sarcasm was made for, Uncle Marty."
"Your heart rate," Kayla says. "Is it elevated?"
"It doesn't feel like it. It's like I said. The feeling in my bones and what you saw me do. It's pretty simple."
"This is not simple," Kayla whispers. "This is not simple, but this is..."
For a second, Charlotte thinks that Kayla has literally lost her mind. How else do you explain it when a grown woman starts suddenly jumping up and down and clapping her hands together and cackling like a hyena?
"Oh my God! Oh my God!"
Kayla cries over and over again. She looks like she just won the lottery. But even in the midst of her joy, she doesn't allow anything less than 5 feet of space between herself and Charlotte. Now it's clear why Kayla had such a hard time believing her story. She wanted it to be true so much she didn't trust herself. She wanted it to be true the way we want fairy tales and romance novels and Santa Claus to be true. And now that she has undeniable proof, it's like she's a child again. Charlotte laughs, then feels awestruck that she can laugh. That even as the drug courses through her, making the impossible possible, she has all her human emotions within reach.
"Women,"
Marty mutters. Charlotte makes a fake grab for his throat and he goes skittering backwards so quickly he ends up on his ass, which only makes Kayla laugh louder, which only makes Charlotte laugh louder. "If it's anything like last night, we've got 3 hours," Charlotte says, once she catches her breath. "Let's play." 17.
"Again,"
Marty says to Kayla.
"I've circled twice, Marty. Nobody's here." "Third time's a charm."
"For you and the eye doctor, maybe," she grumbles. Kayla's right, the place does look abandoned. The warehouse has meteor-sized holes in its walls. Weeds grow in the broken asphalt of its empty loading docks. The chain-link fence looks relatively new, like someone threw it up for protection after the last tenant left, but even it's collapsing in sections. By the time her companions start arguing over which particular nest of shadows will conceal the car best, Charlotte's managed to thread her hair into a ponytail without tearing out large chunks by the roots. Together with the fact that she hasn't torn a hole in any part of Kayla's back seat, this accomplishment makes her feel pretty damn proud of herself. Inside, they find almost nothing Charlotte cannot bend to the point of breaking. She's most impressed with what the drug does to her aim. After snapping some rebar with her bare hands, she's able to throw pieces of it through the air with enough force to spear the wall from what would amount to 2 car lengths away. A trick similar to what she did outside the bar when she sent the steel spike into the ground. To overcome gravity like this, from this distance, an ordinary human would require impeccable aim. For her, it's not an issue, because of the insane amount of propulsion that comes from even the lightest flick of her wrist. With each successful hit, she takes another step back. Eventually, she discovers the point at which distance overcomes her enhanced strength. At about 3 car lengths between her and the wall, the rebar starts to fall short. "We need to film this," Charlotte says.
"You sure about that?" Kayla asks.
"I'm sure I've only got 1 pack of pills, and if I run out and nobody believes me, there's going to be no way to prove we're not all crazy."
"You planning to tell the world about this?"
Marty asks.
"I don't know yet."
"I don't know anything yet. But if we have to tell someone, I want to be believed." Charlotte begins rubbing 2 pieces of rebar together to see how long it takes her to make sparks. The answer? 10 seconds. They light up the vast, shadowy interior of the warehouse, making it clear how much her eyes have adjusted to the darkness.
"I'm not trying to be a pain in the ass," Marty says. "I just don't think it's a good idea to have any of this on film. Not yet."
"I understand you feel that way. And I'm not asking you to store it on your phone for longer than it takes to transfer it to some kind of portable hard drive. And I don't want either of you on camera. I'll keep you out of it as best I can, I promise. But I've got to have some kind of record that this is actually happening." Marty's staring at her wide-eyed and frightened. It takes her a few seconds to realize it's not the prospect of putting all this on film that's got him scared. Not in this moment, at least. It's that she just gave him an order in a firm tone of voice. And right now, when she's capable of breaking steel, her orders mean more than they did an hour ago.
"You've got the pills, Charlie," Kayla says.
"That's your proof."
"Yeah, and we saw how easy it was to prove they work. All I have to do is set myself up to be raped and murdered. You can't trick this drug, guys. If I know the threat's not real, nothing happens. I mean, come on. Imagine I'm in police custody, trying to get them to believe my story, but the only way to prove it is to get them to drop me in the worst neighborhood in town, where I might end up breaking some guy's neck or, you know, destroying private property. Do you really see that going well for me?"
It's dark again inside the warehouse, but she can tell from the shapes of their bowed heads they're studying the shadows at their feet, considering her words.
"Also, there's another reason we need the film," she says.
"What's that?"
Marty asks. "It might be all you guys have if something happens to me."
"All right now,"
Marty says, closing the distance between them. He seems to have forgotten what she's capable of until he's curled an arm around her back. By then, it's too late to pull away without being insultingly obvious about it. But he does stiffen briefly before he begins walking her toward the ruined entrance.
"Nothing's gonna happen to you, Charlie. Come on. Let's go do your little movie shoot. We've only got 2 hours left."
They'd agreed to do the shoot back at the safe house. When they'd first rolled up and Kayla and Marty had asked her to hang back while they cased the place, she'd had to remind them she was the one capable of breaking someone's spine with a light shove, so why not have her go in first? With bowed heads, they'd complied. The house had turned out to be as empty as they'd left it. Now, the shoot complete, she's in the shower, washing off the grime of that awful bar, scrubbing her ear of the sticky film left by her assailant's hot whiskey breath. The strength left her a few minutes ago, 3 hours after being triggered, just as she'd expected. And even though she feels newly vulnerable, there's a comfort to knowing the pill keeps a regular schedule, that parts of it are knowable, quantifiable. It makes it seem a little less frightening than it was the night before. Under the spray, she studies the mottled skin on her hand. She'd spent several minutes passing it back and forth through the stove's open flame while Marty filmed. The skin should be badly discolored, but instead it looks like it's been drawn on with a red marker, and the ink has already started to fade. The effect was similar to when she pressed the spike against her palm. A riot of sudden bruising, accompanied by dull pain that was mostly pressure. There's probably some threshold, some intensity level at which the heat and the flames become unbearable. But if the first test is any indicator, it's more than can be produced by a single stove. Recounting her story for the unbiased lens on Marty's phone felt therapeutic, more cathartic than repeating it to Kayla and Marty, maybe because she didn't feel like she had to make anyone believe her. The proof was right there, in her hands, in the way the flames kissed her skin. For good measure, she also bent several pieces of rebar they'd brought from the warehouse and cracked some chunks of concrete, the latter of which Kayla and Marty convinced her to carry in from the car, with the two of them flanking her like Secret Service agents so nosy neighbors couldn't observe her impossible strength. There'd been one other endurance test she'd wanted to try, but when she asked them to head out to the backyard with her, they just glared at her. Good call, she thinks now. Maybe I'm not ready to try taking a bullet either. But there was another test they had agreed to help with. Once they'd finished making the video, Kayla drove to a gas station and came back with a box of wine and 2 bottles of vodka. Charlotte has always been a lightweight. One glass of wine usually makes her powerfully dizzy. And the hard stuff makes her sick to her stomach after a few swallows. Given her past and her grandmother's genes, she's always figured this for a blessing. Her weak stomach and delicate sense of balance are probably what kept her from self-medicating over the years. But they also ruled out evening libations as potential sleep aids, which made her more vulnerable to Dylan's plot. So maybe she shouldn't be so grateful for these metabolic quirks. Not yet, anyway. But with Zyprexin thundering through her system, she was able to drink 2 glasses of straight vodka without so much as a wince. Same story with the wine. As Marty and Kayla looked on in astonishment, she metabolized both bottles like they were iced water with lemon. The pill doesn't give her just strength, but a kind of temporary imperviousness to any physical limitation. Except flying, she thinks, laughing under her breath. But maybe if I ran fast enough to get started... There's a knock at the door. It's Marty checking to make sure she's okay. A few minutes later, she's toweling off, realizing she's got no idea where she's headed next, and wondering if she should have been giving more thought to that than to Dylan's deceptions and magic pills. Is she spending the night here? The choice makes her feel suddenly exhausted. In the way everything she did while on the drug should have made her feel, but didn't. What would the AA folks say? 1 step at a time. Which in this particular instance means it's a better idea to change into a real outfit, and not pajamas. Kayla and Marty are waiting for her in the living room. They've got steaming cups of coffee, which they're taking absent sips from as they watch Jason's disposable phone do absolutely nothing on the coffee table between them. They'd bought a charger for the thing when they bought Charlotte's change of clothes. Neither of them looks the slightest bit tired, even though it's after 2 in the morning.
I don't mean to be blunt, Marty says. But should you really be carrying around the cell phone of a guy who tried to rape you?
It's a disposable, Kayla said.
I looked it up online. It sells for about $20.
Guess that's why it looks a decade old, Charlie says. He probably bought it for cash. And it's Dylan's only way of getting in touch with me.
Which he hasn't done,
Marty says.
Which is strange.
He seems like a pretty resourceful bastard psychopath asshole, Kayla says. Something tells me he'd find a way to get in touch with you even if he lost the number to Briffle's burner.
We'll get you a new phone on the way to Altamira,
Marty says.
Altamira, Kayla says.
Hiding out in her former hometown, that sounds like a good plan to you?
She doesn't even know who she's hiding from. How's she gonna figure out the best place to hide? He might know where she is right now, I don't know.
He knows everything, Charlotte says quietly. He knows everything about me. For 3 months, I met him once a week and I told him everything. He knows how I lost my virginity. He knows everything I'm afraid of. He knows what my favorite movies are, my favorite books. There's no hiding from him. There's no hiding from what I told him.
You're not just saying this because you want to go home again, Kayla asks.
What am I going to do, change my name again? Go off the grid again? Look how well it worked out the first time.
I mean, here we are in the middle of... whatever the fuck this is.
He found me before, he'll find me again.
Now, wait a minute, Kayla says. We don't have any evidence he targeted you because of your background. He could have been stalking that health center for anybody he thought was right for this plan of his. Any damaged, frightened woman who walked through the door. And with your background, you just turned out to be the supercharged version of what he was already looking for.
Which explains why he put in 3 months of work on you,
Marty offers.
Maybe, Charlotte says.
Or maybe not,
Marty adds quietly.
Look, all I'm saying is there's no perfect decision here, so she might as well make the one that's best for her.
And you think that's going back to Altamira? With you? Kayla's not giving in easily, but there's less bite in her tone. And it feels to Charlotte like she's transitioned into a cooler, analytical mode.
The one time that Briffle asshole tried to make trouble for her in Altamira, we showed him to the freeway and he never came back. A lot of guys that helped me that night, they're still there. They're still sober. They still do what I say.
Charlie, Kayla asks, what do you want to do?
One thing, though, if you do decide to come back,
Marty says.
There's something I need to take care of first.
Oh, Lord, Kayla says. What does that mean? Shaking his head, Marty says.
Just something weird I gotta figure out.
Weirder than everything else that's happened tonight? Kayla asks.
I just gotta find out if it's a coincidence or not.
To Charlotte, he says.
You remember a guy named Luke Prescott?
Luke Prescott. The name comes out like an involuntary grunt. Hearing it now in the midst of all this is like waking from a coma to be told your dog tore apart the living room. Luke Prescott. A guy who treated her like she was some dark force invading their pristine small-town high school, all because she got called on more in class than he did. Which was because she knew the right answer a lot more often than he did. He was a slick bastard, even at 17. Sometimes his strategy against her worked. Other times it got his ass called to the carpet. By constantly accusing her of trying to work her past for sympathy, he was able to hang that past around her neck like a scarlet letter. Years ago, she would have called him a bully. Now she thinks back on his bullshit and just finds it competitive and desperate. Luke tried to be smarter and better at everything than anyone. With her, he had just had big, obvious targets to use. Whatever his motives, Luke was the primary reason her life in Altamira didn't turn out to be quite as normal or pristine as she would have liked it to be. As Luann would have liked it to be. The guy made it his job to constantly remind everyone of what had happened to her and where she'd come from. And always in a way that hinted she might have been perverted by the darkness she'd been exposed to at such a young age. Why are we talking about Luke Prescott right now? Charlotte asks.
He's back in town, Marty answers.
And the circumstances of his return are a little weird. They sound a lot weirder now in light of all this.
Slow down. You think Luke Prescott is working with Dylan? I thought that guy would be some asshole lawyer by now.
Hey, Kayla whispers. For the bad guys. You work for the good guys. Marty, what are you talking about?
Prescott's one of Mona's deputies now.
What?
Yeah. Apparently he went up to San Francisco State, learned a couple different foreign languages, graduated with honors, got an MBA. Was all prepped to ace his interview for the FBI. And for some reason, he doesn't get past the front door and he's back in Altamira, hanging his head and asking Mona for a job.
Nothing against Altamira, but that's a pretty long fall, Kayla says.
Exactly, Marty says. And it's suspicious.
You don't think he interviewed with the FBI? Charlotte asks.
No, I think he did. What if the FBI's involved in this somehow? What if he's working for them?
That's a reach, Marty, Kayla says.
You want to know where I was when you called me? I was at the Copper Pot with Luke, who was asking me for your contact information so he could apologize. When did you say this Dylan guy first approached you? About 3 months ago, right?
Charlotte nods.
That's around when Luke first got in touch with Mona. She had a deputy set to retire, Bill Poindexter, so Luke had to wait until early this month to start.
That's still a reach, Kayla says.
About 12 hours ago, this would have all seemed like a reach, Kayla.
Still, she says.
Guy comes crawling home with egg on his face. Knows he's going to be seeing folks he was a dick to back in the day. Makes sense he would try to make amends. Look, I knew Prescott. Charlie knew Prescott. The kid thought he might run the FBI someday. Now, there's only two ways an arrogant know-it-all like that's gonna come crawling back home on his hands and knees. One, he knows he's never got a shot in hell at a government job. Or two, he's made some kind of backroom deal that guarantees him one if he does something else first.
I need a nap, Kayla says.
This is making my head hurt.
And, Charlotte says, I should add that Marty also believes that space aliens have infiltrated our government at the highest levels.
My personal beliefs about our country's strained relationship with extraterrestrial life is a complicated conversation for another evening,
Marty says.
The point here is that I need to make sure Luke isn't trying to set some kind of trap with his apology business.
No. Charlotte says. I do.
You're going to take one of your pills before you do it?
Kayla asks. The lawyer's penetrating glare is on her now, and not Marty.
I don't know,
she says, averting her eyes. I'm almost out.
And you've got big plans for the ones you have left? Kayla asks.
Let's take this one step at a time, Charlotte says, forcing herself to look into Kayla's eyes again.
Uh-oh, her lawyer says with a half-smile. Looks like someone's been bit by the superhero bug. You believe me, Charlie?
Marty asks. I believe you're right. We have to be sure. And even if it's bullshit, I won't mind hearing an apology out of Luke Prescott's mouth. The guy was a real jerk.
Still. Try not to break his neck or throw him into a tree.
I won't be able to if he doesn't attack me, Charlotte says. Marty stands.
Now? Kayla asks. You're gonna head out now. Better to arrive in the dark when most of the town's asleep,
he says.
As for me, I probably won't be sleeping for the next 5 years or anyway, so ready, Charlie?
She hadn't thought it all the way through, but she's relieved to have an objective, a direction. And after the dislocation of the past 24 hours, the prospect of some kind of homecoming, a return to the familiar, slows her heart rate some, makes her feel as if she's coming to rest on something soft. So she stands, too, And then Kayla stands. And suddenly the three of them are staring at each other as if they all feel like they've forgotten some important piece of business. But Charlotte can tell the desire to keep moving is strong in all of them, driven in no small part, she fears, by a desire to leave all the dread that seems to radiate from this little prison of a house.
All right, Kayla says, clearing her throat. I guess I'll head back to the city. See if whoever's investigating the biker blast has made any noise about your house.
Thank you. Seriously, Kayla, I can't thank you enough for what you've done.
Well, when you see my bill, maybe you'll feel differently. Jesus Christ, Marty grumbles. Really?
No, not really. Kayla rolls her eyes.
But don't thank me yet. I'm not done. None of us are.
She hugs Charlotte quickly but firmly, as if she fears committing to the embrace fully will unleash some storm of further emotion that will do them all in. She offers a smile. She's halfway out the door when Charlotte says, "Call me when you get home safe."
"On what?"
Kayla asks.
"Jason's burner?" "No, thanks. I don't call dead people." "Call me,"
Marty says.
"I'm listed." "Let's not move too fast, Marty."
As Kayla pulls the door shut behind her, she points to the electronic peephole viewer on the wall next to her. Marty steps forward, makes sure the door closes all the way, and watches as she makes her way to her BMW. "You two would make a cute couple," Charlotte says.
"Yeah, we're a regular Mothra and Godzilla."
18.
"This is a mistake, Cole."
Cole looks at the paper cup of coffee trembling in the armrest next to him. He's pretty wired already, so maybe his director of security is right. Maybe he should lay off the caffeine. But surely that's not what Ed means. The man wouldn't care if Cole were guzzling whiskey on the way to this meeting. It's the meeting, he objects to. And he's probably also a little pissed Cole refused to let several well-armed members of their private security team travel alongside them in the leather-upholstered passenger compartment of this spacious helicopter. But he'd never say so directly. Ed's nothing if not loyal, one of the only holdovers from his father's era who's never treated Cole with anything less than respect. He's a giant of a man. A former deputy chief for the LAPD who headed up their counterterrorism and special operations bureaus before entering the far more lucrative world of private security. His shiny, bald dome reflects the morning sunlight streaming through the panoramic windows with such intensity Cole's afraid to remove his sunglasses. Because the man's mouth rarely changes from a thin, determined line, Cole's left with no choice but to view the slight grimace Ed's worn since they took off as a sign the man's truly afraid of what Dylan might be capable of.
"Are they in place?" Cole asks. "We'll have snipers north and south." "Not east and west?" "West to the site's mostly flat wash, with a slight downhill grade until you get to the freeway. Nearest mountains are way too far from the site to have any good perches. Same situation to the east. Also, never a good idea to have snipers staring right into the sun. And given that it's Arizona, the nearest tree is probably in Flagstaff. Or Sedona. Strike team? 15 minutes out. Best we could do given the absence of cover. Which I imagine might be why he picked the place. He's got a special forces background aside from being a mad genius, right? Might explain some of what's in here."
He pulls a stack of pages from his canvas briefcase. It's held together with a giant paperclip, which tells Cole it was printed out just before they took off from downtown San Diego. Whatever's in it, his security director didn't want to share it over email. "Good call," he thinks, as soon as he starts reading. It's confidential information about the biker massacre in the middle of the Arizona desert. There are some initial police reports from the first investigators to arrive on scene. Reports pulled off law enforcement servers the public would like to think are a lot more secure than they actually are. They're followed by a transcript made up of a series of fragmented conversations. The name of the person speaking is provided wherever possible, but in most cases the hackers made educated guesses, such as Officer One, possible ATF agent, as they dipped in and out of the mobile devices being carried by the investigators on scene, eavesdropped